You're listening to the Men Overseas Podcast, a show that explores methods and ideas to help you live a bigger life. You will hear interesting stories of how people live, how they save and invest their money, and why having time wealth is better than being a billionaire. If you are entertained, educated, or elevated, be sure to hit the subscribe button. We're just getting started. Now here is your host, Brad D'Antonio.
Welcome, you beautiful people, my favorite MFs. Glad you're here with me today. We're going to talk about the afterlife, and I've got a reframe for you here. I'll talk about the latest and the biggest theater production in American history. That'll be part of the Best Movie Ever update. That happened in January of 21, the big theater productions. We'll do some tech talk, or AI to be more specific. And money stuff to close out. And I think I have a kid say the darndest things, too. But we're going to do funnies first. John Katz on X says, society peaked around the same time dudes were wearing those Big Johnson t-shirts. He could be right. I'm not sure when we peaked. But this one's from Memorial Day weekend, and it's from Karen McGee. She says, my body is a machine that turns domestic beers and grilled meats into respect for all those who served. Yeah, a lot of people forget why we're barbecuing at all. You've got to be reminded sometimes. Someone asks on X, what's a hill you're willing to die on? And Mo Muller responds, umpires shouldn't have to be celibate. I like that one a lot. Involuntarily so, I might add. Or at least they act as though that is the case. Nat Sawyer. I assume Nat is short for Natalie because it appears to be a woman. She posted the feminine urge to reply to a statistical generalization with an anecdotal counterexample. And the top comment goes to Allie Beth Stuckey, who said, I've seen a guy do this too, though. She did the meme. But I know that she is a conservative, traditional sort of woman, so I think maybe she was being funny, but I can't be sure. You know, I might be reaching that age where I need to start doing an obit segment on the pod, because, you know, the older you get, the more people are going to pass. It's just part of getting older. I'm up to three guys now who I played ball with in college as a teammate who are no longer with us. A guy I played with in high school, I didn't mention this about a month ago, Ty Garner, his dad, Phil Garner, former Astro, he passed away about a month ago. The only thing I remember him saying to me, he was throwing his batting practice underneath the stadium where the Aggies play, Olsen Field. I think they still play there. I'm not sure. This was the fall of my junior year, so back in the 20th century. He said, I'll bet you're fast. And I laughed, and I said, why do you say that? And he said, the way you wear your pants. And so from then on, probably 90% of the rest of my playing days, I wore my pants up because Phil Garner said I looked fast. Kyle Busch, staying on the obit section. Kyle Busch, the race car driver, died of sepsis at age 41. I guess one of the upsides, sadly, of living long enough to see a lot of people die is it makes you appreciate having gotten more time than they did. Does anybody else think like that? Like when I passed the age that Kobe was when he died at 43, I thought, oh, I got more time on earth than Kobe. But who knows? They might all be looking down saying life is suffering. And if you only knew how heavenly heaven is, you wish you'd have gotten the call up sooner. He being capitalized there. And you might think, well, I want to spend more time with my kids and potentially my grandkids someday. Yeah, but what if death is like an Ibogaine journey, which what I got to see on Ibogaine, which a lot of people report seeing too, is the trip. It's like a hyper-lucidity. Everything is hyper-lucid, and it's more real, which sounds crazy. It's more real than real life. When you're interacting with people, which doesn't even make sense. But the way that my journey started, there was this old man who had a handkerchief And he pulled it out and he started wiping the glass for me. And his face became so incredibly vivid and real. And I could see all the lines and contours of his aging face. It was incredible. And then thereafter, once I swiped left, so to speak, with my mind, which they tell you you can do if you don't, if you want to move on to the next vision. I mean, it's really, you really anticipate, oh, what's going to come next? Everything afterward was hyperlucid too. So I guess what I'm saying is, what if heaven is like that and you're interacting not just with your loved ones who've passed, but which we all kind of hope, right, to be united with our loved ones someday? Do you remember the book Some? It's 40 Tales of the Afterlives by David Eagleman. I've talked about it before. It's a bunch of theories of what happens after you die. And I find it intellectually stimulating, even as a Christian. Just the same with simulation theory. I find it fun to talk about. Well, in one of the chapters in the book, one of his theories of the afterlife is you'd still be on Earth. So it's the second chapter. It's called Circle of Friends. And the theory is that the afterlife contains only the people you remember from living, from your lived experience, to use a phrase I prefer not to use. But in the days you're living, not lived experience in the DEI sense. I'm not going to get into my truth and your truth. Those days are dead. Bad use of words there. But your lived experience, your actual lived life. And in this theory of this afterlife in this book, you're still here on Earth, but it's just people you remember. So you're on the same Earth. You'd wake up tomorrow and brush your teeth the same way. You still wake up married with kids, brush your teeth twice a day. It's not like you're in the clouds with angels flying around or anything. And at first, the thought, as you're reading this chapter, the thought sounds comforting because it brings back family that you've lost. And so all the close friends you've had throughout your life, they might be filling the roles of, you know, any, it could be your second grade teacher is the one who hands you your spicy chicken deluxe at the Chick-fil-A drive-thru. And then your eighth grade tutor is sitting next to you on a half-empty plane. And the girl you had a crush on at band camp, she's the pilot. No, she's not. I'm just kidding about that. There will be no female pilots in heaven. I know. Or former lovers, the one who got away, they'll all be on Earth with you. But there'll hardly be anybody on Earth. There'll hardly be any cars on the road, not a lot of traffic. As I said, the plane would be half empty. The office where you go to work would be nearly empty. So everybody's spread out. But all that's on Earth are those that you remember. Even extended family, third cousins, whatever. They're in this heavenly setup as long as you've met them and then you remember them. That's the key, as long as you remember them in your last days on Earth. But what this also means is you realize all the other people you never did meet in life, but could have. So in this sort of scenario, the heaven on Earth afterlife, you'll never meet anybody new. You're stuck with the, I don't know, 1,200 people or whatever that you remember. So if you shared an elevator with somebody, but you don't remember them, they wouldn't live out eternity with you. But every teacher you had, every girl you gave a smooch, every player that you remember on the opposing team because he was throwing gas and struck you out three times when you were 13, that lefty pitcher when you were 16 who had that nasty slide piece, whatever, you get me, they'll all be there. But basically, your social world after death is going to be limited to what you noticed while you were still alive, those you valued enough to pay attention to. The crazy sports parent, you'd remember that parent. So anyway, they'd all be there. The catch-22 is, great, you get to be with your favorite people forever, but the negative is you might live out eternity with regrets about all the connections you didn't make while you were alive. You know, those people that were just on the edge of your life that you didn't feel like introducing yourself to that day. Or maybe somebody you did talk to, but you never followed up to build a relationship, so you miss out on this person being with you forever. So to sum it up, and if you're like me, you're thinking maybe that's why they called the book Sum, because he sums it all up. That's not the case. I looked it up. Sum is the Latin word for I am, as in I think, therefore I am. Who is the philosopher who came up with that phrase? Anyone? I think, therefore I am. Bueller? It was Descartes, who was a Frenchie, 17th century French philosopher, often referred to as the father of modern Western philosophy. I have a listener who messages me when I pronounce things wrong, which happens on just about every episode. She clowned me on Schopenhauer and Jean-Paul Sartre. I think I said Sartre. But as the saying goes, you got to go easy on people who say things wrong because it means that they learned it from reading. He said, what did he tell me? He said, dude, can you not just put it into Google pronounce? Yeah, I could, but I'm not doing all that. Besides, it gives me a reason for you to give me feedback, and I love hearing from y'all. So, but let me sum up the chapter called Circle of Friends, because it's basically the idea that memory creates your world in the afterlife. And I chose that one to talk about because I think it's one of the more interesting ones. And so the more narrow your life experience, the more narrow your afterlife's going to be. I'll talk in a minute about how the more you know, the more enriched your life can be on Earth. But it's always fun to think about how, like, what you believe happens after you die could impact how you live. Or not could. I shouldn't say could. Strong belief systems definitely determine how you live, which is why we try to instill certain belief systems in our kids, guiding principles for how to live. It's about 3/4 of the world, 3/4 of humans have a religious or spiritual belief system that they follow. And in the U.S., it's more like 47% of Americans now describe themselves as religious. About 1/3 of Americans say they're spiritual but not religious. And the rest, I guess, are neither. Something I talked about a few episodes ago was acting as though you're the protagonist in a movie and how that might get your butt off the couch and get you to meet more people so as not to give viewers a boring movie to watch. So even if you're just pretending for a day to have a certain belief system, even if you don't believe it, just pretend, that could motivate you to do more and become more and just become more than you already are by adopting a certain belief system. But some people are not able to pretend. But some people are really good at pretending, and I'll get into one of those guys specifically in a little bit here. Scott Adams had a reframe for this in his book. He said, the usual frame of reality is objective, and science helps us understand it. But his reframe was, our so-called reality is a simulation created by a higher intelligence. He says, if we're in a simulation, what is the point of it all? He said, well, I can think of several. And his best one, in my opinion, is that maybe we're avatars or characters in some sort of like a massive video game. And the way that you would win is by producing the most kids or making the most money or having the most impact. You know, he liked to say that if we're simulated or if we knew that we were simulated, the benefit would be feeling like you can author the game as you go, as you live. Like if you focus intensely enough on what you want, that alone could hack the simulation to produce the sort of changes that you're aiming for. And some call this affirmations. It could be part of goal setting, the law of attraction, deep prayer, you know, whatever it is. But he says people who think this way, they tend to get a lot of what they want compared to those who have other filters on reality. And he uses himself as an example. He uses Elon Musk as an example. These guys feel like they've created their life. They've authored their reality. And I believe a lot of that to some extent. I believe you create your own reality with your mind, especially like how you interpret things and keep moving forward. And there's so many things that have happened in my life because I prayed for them. Prayer was, and that's my example, prayer. He didn't give that example. He wasn't a prayerful person, although he said he was giving his life to Christ in his final hours, primarily to appease friends of his, I think, but he wasn't a believer throughout his life. He was doing a calculated risk thing at the end of his life. Nerd. But I really miss him. But even just focusing on something, like truly desiring something, I would say that works more times than not. You know, we have this burning desire for something to happen, And I don't just mean positive stuff. Like, I was thinking about this the other day, like the problems I have with my neck. I remember the first time I ever saw a machine at the gym to work out your neck. And I thought, well, who uses that? And the only people I could think about or think of with big necks were wrestlers and big offensive linemen who had these huge necks. So I was probably in eighth grade when I saw this neck machine, and I never thought about it until I was in my early 30s. By that time, I'd been working out for almost 20 years, and I realized that I had never seen a neck machine, or I hadn't seen one in years. And I definitely never used one. And I started to wonder, well, what if I have a weak neck? Like, what if there's an imbalance where my upper back muscles are strong, but my neck isn't? And yeah, I don't know. I'd been exercising for so long and was like, well, I'm doing okay. And then I remember reading up on it. Whatever I read said basically, don't work out your neck in one of those machines. But I probably should have been doing something, I guess. Because I've had serious neck problems now for, we're going on 3 years, and it's miserable. But listeners tell me they can't tell. So I do. I like to keep it that way. I record these episodes at the time of the week when I feel most up to it, which is usually late morning, early to late morning, on a morning that I'm not going to physical therapy. On page 196 of Reframe Your Brain, Adams writes, if you believe you can author the simulation with your intentions, you're likely to experience a reality in which that seems to be exactly what's happening. That's how I experience life. Even my bad luck seems eerily similar to things I had been thinking about too much, as if I created it by mistake. Many people who practice affirmations tell me about their experiences. They too feel as if they're authoring their own destiny. It's interesting to ponder. Rob Bass died. I guess I'm still on obits. Rob Bass died last week at age 59. He had stage 4 lung cancer. So he and DJ Easy Rock are no longer with us. He died in 2014. They had 2 big hits when I was a kid. It Takes Two and Joy, Pump, Pump, Pump It Up, Pain. Joy and Pain. Ever tell you the story of calling B97 when I was at my cousin's house in New Orleans one night? I must have been 9. The song came out in 89, I believe. So I would have been in 4th grade then. And so I called one night. This was probably a Friday night. And I fell asleep with the phone next to me. And when I woke up in the morning, the phone was still ringing. So I never called a radio station again. Well, actually, I did once. I'll have to tell you that story another time. But yeah, the song I was calling to request was Joy and Pain. Let me share with you my favorite chapter from that book, Some. It's actually the first one. As most authors do, he put the best at the beginning so you can get hooked and keep reading. The way this theory goes, and I hope this is interesting to you, it's fun for me to ponder, so thanks for entertaining me or obliging me. The theory goes, in the afterlife, all your experiences in life are reordered, and those things you do that share some commonality are grouped together. So, for example, you would spend 2 straight months driving, 7 months having sex, all the pain you've experienced, that would happen all at once. So maybe you'd spend 27 hours in serious pain and then it'd be done. And then you could do the sleeping part. He says you'd spend 6 days clipping your toenails, 15 months looking for lost items. Sounds like a lot, right? You don't spend that much time looking for stuff. Like, he's taking people at their word when they say, oh, I've been looking for this all week. You know, you take breaks. Like, he took them Rick Perry literally. You'd have 2 years of straight boredom, he says, just looking out the window. Less so, I suppose, if you never knew life before the internet. 18 months of waiting in line, which people don't seem to mind to do much anymore because they look on their phones while they're waiting. He says, your eyes hurt and you itch because it isn't yet time for your marathon 200-hour shower. Yeah, I forgot about that. So you'd have to be dirty most of the time. Unless you can get that 200-hour shower to last, but I don't think that's going to last too long. Now, this one's good and appropriate. He says, you spend 1 week thinking about what happens when you die. You spend 3 weeks realizing you were wrong about something, 2 straight weeks lying, 7 hours vomiting, 3 months doing laundry, 14 minutes experiencing pure joy and bliss, and 3 days calculating restaurant tips. Side note, the last restaurant I went to where the minimum tip option was 20%, I did them a real solid. I took the time to give them a custom tip. 5 days just operating buttons and zippers, and I'll save the best for last. 4 minutes wondering what your life would be like if you reshuffled the order of events in your life. Well, we just spent about 60 seconds on it. How about a sports update? In 2026, so far, there have been about 1,700 calls overturned with the new ABS system in Major League Baseball. 1,700 that umpires got wrong. You know how bad college players get screwed if, because, you know, MLB strike zones are known for being real small, but high school hitters, God, they get effed. Have you heard of the company Big League Advance? So what they do, it's kind of like venture capital, where they invest in a bunch of different upstarts, young players, and hope that one of them becomes a big league star. So they'll give a bunch of different players in A-ball $1 million for a percentage of their future earnings. But if the player doesn't make it to the big leagues, the company loses the bet, and they lose their entire investment of $1 million or whatever they gave different players. Well, the highest profile one of these, and it was on the news recently because the player filed a lawsuit and lost. So in 2017, this company, Big League Advance, gave Fernando Tatis Jr. $2 million when he was just 18. And in exchange, Tatis agreed to give him 10% of his future earnings. And Tatis has said that what that enabled him to do, getting $2 million at 18 years old, it allowed him to get a nice apartment. It allowed him to eat better. He paid for a personal trainer, that kind of thing. Well, Tatis Jr. in 2021 signs a 14-year, $340 million contract with the Padres, which means Big League Advance, the company, was owed $34 million, 10% of $340 million, plus any additional earnings that he might get later. So Tatis Jr. sued Big League Advance because he said that the deal was predatory, or one-sided, lopsided. And you know what that reminds me of? Well, 2 things. One, for those of you who listened to my episode about Iran, this should sound familiar. It's what the Iranians did after the British struck oil. Oh, you risked a bunch of money, and just to see if you'd get a, hoping that you'd get a big return on your money. So you're like, sure, I'll take that bet. Sounds fair to me. Where do I sign? And then one side gets all the benefits in the early years, in this case, the Iranians, or in this case, Fernando Tatis Jr., and then the other side hopes to make a return in the long term. They hope to make a serious return, and then you cry, well, that's not fair. So they want to rip up the contract. It's like doing deals with toddlers. And the other thing it reminds me of, because that's what happened in Iran. Listen to the episode called Iran, How We Got Here, if you want to hear more details on that. But the other thing it reminds me of is the mortgage crisis that we went through in the late 2000s, 08, 09, because Tatis Jr. thought the deal was, quote, predatory. And that's what they called loans given to people who wanted to buy a house. You tell the bank you want to borrow $300,000 to buy a house, and then you sign documents promising to pay the loan back. And then when you can't, you say it's the bank who's the predator. Yeah. I'm sure a politician came up with that word, predator, to describe these loans people got. That was when the Occupy Wall Street nonsense started. Why would a politician do that? Well, because it's easy to pit 99% of the people against 1%. So you do it for the votes. And then behind closed doors, you side with the banks and bail them out, evidently. But with regard to the Iran thing, I was disappointed recently. I listened to Gad Saad. I don't know how to pronounce his name, but he's the author of the book Suicidal Empathy that just came out. So he was on Rogan. This was just a few weeks ago. And Rogan brought up the CIA and British-led coup in Iran to get rid of Mossadegh in 1953. And Gad, sadly, he didn't know enough to counter him with some facts. And so he just kind of conceded whatever point Rogan was making. And I just hate that because Rogan has so many listeners and people need to know what went down there. Since we're talking about it already, let's do an update on the best movie ever. So the full body cam footage from Capitol Police Officer Michael Fanone was released a few days ago. He was the guy who said he suffered, he suffered a heart attack, traumatic brain injury, which we call TBI, a loss of consciousness, repeated taser electrocutions, blunt force trauma, chemical exposure. He also coughed, "Go F yourself," in a hearing. I don't know if you saw that. When he was told by a congressman that the fault doesn't lie with Trump, but it lies with the U.S. Capitol Police leadership. He coughed, "Go F yourself." He also said he suffered post-traumatic stress disorder, severe trauma and anxiety, family trauma, noting that his daughters had to carry the ongoing emotional fallout of nearly losing their father that day. Dude sounds like a little bitch, if you ask me. He's got no business having daughters, especially if you're going to be a police officer of any kind. You're bound to get into a scuffle at some point, a scrum. So was he a crisis actor who was exaggerating? Well, he was definitely exaggerating. He didn't lose consciousness for over 4 minutes, and that was proven out by the body cam footage. And he doesn't seem like a good dude from what I know of him. I know he had a drinking problem at one time. That doesn't make you a bad guy, but I know that he's a former Georgetown prep kid who also attended a boarding school in Maine. The reason he attended Georgetown Prep, which is one of the most elite schools in America, by the way. That's the same school that Supreme Court Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch attended. It's a pretty big deal. And the reason he went there is because his dad, Fanone's dad, was an attorney and wanted to steer his son toward the D.C. elite professional class. So daddy done good if that was the goal, because he's a celebrity now. So his dad's an attorney. How about that? Never would have guessed. I mean, if I had to guess actor or attorney, it would have been a tough call. The tattoos on his hands, and this is kind of hard to believe, but this is true. His hand tattoos say, "I'll take the money, but these fools don't own me." How about that? When there was a nice Asian lady reporter who was walking the halls with him one time, she asked him questions and she said, "Sir, did you turn off your body cam that day on J6? And he said, "No." And she said, "I saw the footage. You turned off your body cam and played dead." And he got so pissed. He used the F word at her and called her a right wing conspiracy theorist. Because what do conspiracists hate most? What would make a guy curse out a little lady? Well, accuse a liar of lying and see how he reacts. If I said to you, "You're a tranny," would you get pissed? No, you wouldn't. You'd think I was nuts or gay for noticing the huge bulge in your Lululemon pants. But if you knew that you were secretly flying to New York City every year for Halloween so you can dress up like Cher or Lady Gaga, you get what I'm putting. You're picking up what I'm putting down, I'm sure. People generally don't get upset and start cursing you out unless they're tucking their junk, unless they're lying and they get caught. And yeah, they don't want you to know what they're up to. If he's acting, which lucky for him, the auto pen gave him a pardon as Biden shuffled out of the White House. If this Fanone fella is acting, I'll give him this. He is so much better than De Niro, who was a pro for a long time. But I think De Niro is just aged out, if I had to guess. And the TDS and loss of testosterone, I think that all plays a part too. But I'm sure it's exhilarating for these guys to get a job acting all of a sudden. I know he's like a paid contributor on CNN, or at least he was. I bet that's fun to do, especially when all the theater kids are cheering you on and you don't even have to be that good at it. A lot of them aren't. And if you get paid for it and you're promised a pardon, hell, they all got pardons, not just the show trials committee, but even the witnesses. So maybe don't hide your kids because they're pardoning everybody up in her. I saw where Trump didn't attend Don Jr.'s wedding. He said it was due to circumstances related to his love for the U.S. of A. He felt it was important for him to remain in D.C. And my thought on it is, if it were Don Jr.'s first marriage, I think he would have been there. Second marriages, unless you've got a widower situation, I don't believe any of your friends or family should feel obligated to attend that second one. Let Elvis marry you, or go the JP route. But don't make your friends spend $3,000 on tuxes and travel and gifts and prepare speeches. Not that a speech costs money, but you know what I'm saying. We're headed to a wedding next weekend, speaking of, in Charleston, South Carolina, a place I've never been. But I'm looking forward to it. The little bro that I never had is getting married. In fact, I call him little bro for reasons that maybe we'll record a pod and explain it. But our life paths are eerily similar. Speaking of cost to attend a wedding, booking a hotel room in Charleston is like booking a hotel room in Tokyo or London. I couldn't believe how expensive they are. So I'm expecting, after visiting, to want to move there because I like it so much. We shall see. But that's not best movie ever stuff. There's usually not much happening in the summer months. But let me share something with you that Balaji said. Balaji Srinivasan, a good follow on X. He's very, very smart. And he posted something that I thought was worth sharing with regard to the best movie ever. It reads, "The Luigi left, Kurt killers, anti-Tesla terrorists, and Altman attackers are already in shoot-on-sight mode against conservatives, libertarians, and technologists. The right isn't there yet. They're called reactionaries because they only react, so they're always one cycle behind. Thus, the left has already started shooting while the right is still only mirroring the lawfare of last decade's left. But anyone can see how incandescently angry the American right is getting, so one can expect them to mirror leftist tactics eventually, just as J6 followed BLM. A problem then arises. You see, when communists and nationalists duke it out, technologists tend to be hated by both sides and tend to leave. That's what happened in Europe. In the early 1900s, Europe was the undisputed center of science. But then the far left rose to power in Russia, and in response arose a far right in Germany, and then those two psychotic factions blew each other up and took much of Europe with them." I was watching a documentary the other night on Operation Barbarossa, which is considered the largest military operation in history. That's when Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union in 1941. The Soviets lost about 5 million lives, but they won the battle against the Nazis, thanks to the most brutal weather of the 20th century up to that point. How about that? One of 41 worst weather yet of the 1900s. And if it weren't for that, Moscow may have fallen to the Nazis. So Hitler's dream of wiping out communism and taking Moscow, he wanted to do that by December of 41. None of that came to pass. And the rest, as they say, is history that I like to share with you every once in a while. Balaji's point is that the scientists with options are going to leave for greener pastures. So basically, he's saying that the United States is becoming more and more divided, the left and the right, and that it could get worse in short order. And he's comparing that possibility to what happened in Europe in early 20th century, when these extreme political movements caused so much chaos and war and destruction and death. And because of all the instability that all that brought about, a lot of scientists and smart people left Europe and came to the U.S., where things are more stable, which of course helped us to defeat the Japanese, developing the bombs and such in World War II. He's saying that when a country becomes too divided or unstable, that the most talented people, especially in the sciences and technology, they're likely going to leave to find a safer place to do their thing. And he's saying something similar could happen very soon here if the U.S. becomes too divided, if it keeps growing between the gap between the left and right. We might stop being the best place for thinkers and innovators And as a result, all the new ideas they come up with, all the new technologies that will be created, all of that will come about in another part of the world. And they'll get major progress there and an increased standard of living. It would all shift. The highest standard of living in the world would shift to those countries instead. As you've heard me say many times, one of the most glaring things about traveling around the world, and I got a dose of this right away, because when I first started traveling on my trip around the world, I started in the UK, and I quickly realized America's standard of living is so much higher than theirs, and you start to notice it in every little thing, from the cars you see on the road to the, I mean, you, like in America, you hardly ever see a hoopty rolling tailpipe dragon. But in countries like Bolivia, that's all you see. But even in the UK, it's a process just to get hot water, like when you're ready to take a shower or to make coffee in the morning. Hey, maybe that's why they drink so much tea. I don't know. But just, yeah, to take a shower, to get the water hot, to dry your clothes, they hang them out to dry, you know, all these things that take a while and we kind of take it for granted. And did you see France, speaking of Europe, did you see they banned nicotine pouches? Good job, Frenchies. They allow rapists from North Africa and Pakistan and Muslims who kill infidels. All that's okay. But Zens, no, can't come in here with Zens. There are some interesting things happening in tech right now, in AI. Mr. Wonderful said he's turned over 90 pages of evidence that there's a coordinated PR war that's happening around energy infrastructure and all the data centers they're trying to build, which makes sense, right? You've got the enemies within, those being the progressives who don't like progress, who rail against the millionaires and billionaires. Not really, just billionaires. Once you become a millionaire, you no longer include millionaires when you're complaining about millionaires and billionaires, Bernie and them. They're conspiring with the party to try to prevent the construction of data centers, that party being the global communists, and their war on America, the war on freedom itself, which I was going to talk about climate change, but I think you get tired of hearing me talk about that. You realize the only people who don't like conspiracy theories are the conspiracists. That's it. Those are the only people who don't like conspiracy theories. It's the conspiracists. Which speaks to the guy I mentioned earlier, cursing out the Asian lady. Mark Andreessen was on Rogan, and that dude never misses. He was one of the guys. Mark Andreessen talks so fast, you really got to focus to get it all. But I'll give you some of my biggest takeaways from that episode. So he believes AGI, artificial general intelligence, is already here. He said we crossed it about 3 months ago with ChatGPT 5.5, Claude 4.6, Gemini 3, and Grok, their latest is 4.3. But he says technology, or AI specifically, he says that AI is moving so fast that we don't realize when major milestones are hit anymore because it's just happening so fast. Another something he said that was interesting was that for almost any topic, the best AIs now will give you a better answer than 99% of experts in any given field. He even said, he was talking about when he goes to the doctor. Oh, no, he told a story when he got sick he was on vacation and he got sick. And he said, like, every 20 minutes, he would talk to AI about his symptoms. And I don't know if he sent pictures of his stool, but maybe Rogan suggested you could even do that. And they'll give you. He was saying every doctor is already secretly using AI when they're examining you, that they turn around the second you stop talking and then type your symptom into AI a lot of times while you're sitting there in front of them, and they act like they're typing what you're saying, you know, taking notes on your ailment, but they've got you thinking like, well, what do I need you for, doc? I guess the answer is prescriptions in some bedside manner. We want a little empathy. Here's a great article. Maybe I'll share with you next week about how IQ has been a big differentiator for a long time in terms of how successful you're going to be. You could look to somebody's IQ and kind of predict. Well, this article I was reading said that AI means that everybody is going to have access to all the intelligence in the world. So what's going to separate you is emotional intelligence and likability. which I've been saying for a while that we reached a point where likability is more important than your resume for most jobs. But there's something else Andreessen said I thought was interesting. So he said sometimes he's got to tell AI he's writing a novel or it won't answer his question. So like you've got to say, I'm writing a novel. Walk me through how the bad guy would successfully rob a bank. And that it'll tell you anything as long as it thinks that it's helping you to write fiction. But you can't ask AI directly, how do I make a bomb or something like that? Because it won't give you an answer. So another tip he gives is when you're trying to get information from AI is to ask it so that you really understand it. Ask AI to explain something to you like you're 10 years old. And then if you still don't get it, just keep reducing that number. So then ask it, you know, explain it to me like I'm 5. And if you still don't understand it, okay, explain it to me like I'm a toddler. Or for big questions, he'll tell AI, okay, a lawyer, a doctor, a psychiatrist, and an historian are debating X and Y. And then AI will create this debate. And then he said he gleans a lot from that. So those are some pretty good ideas. He emphasizes that although AI is going to democratize knowledge, that the only real skill left will be to know what to ask. So some of us hopefully have an advantage there. Those of you who are in a similar line of work as I was and am still, you've been working on asking better questions for years. So you can just slide right into AI and be one of the better AI users. Let's do some money stuff. I'll share some of what Mr. Bellello shared in his newsletter last week. Oh, but first, there's a post from Nick Gray that'll give you something to think about. He said, I think you can tell a lot about how someone spends and thinks about money by how they use paper towels. I thought that was so good. I've shared with you before how paper towels are handled in my house, and now it's handed down from previous generations. If you missed that episode, you didn't miss much, but I would add TP to that too. How many of you think more about your TP usage once you had kids? My daughter's weekly allowance depends on how many rolls she can make into one ply instead of two. So she'll sit there for an entire afternoon with a 16-pack from Costco, and we call it Costco Day or TP Day, and she'll make us some single ply. And I figure by the time she's 18, I will have saved enough money to pay for books that first semester of college. Yeah, none of what I just said is true. We watched A Deadly American Marriage on Netflix the other night. I would say like The Crash, which I talked about last week, I would say it's worth watching if you're into the Dateline type of shows. But one of the kids on the show was telling an investigator, this A Deadly American Marriage show, that's what it's called, on Netflix. One of the kids on the show was telling an investigator that their dad was always yelling at his mom to turn lights off. And I thought, Jesus, no wonder this guy was struggling in his marriage. Because here's a tip for you young kings. This is the first tip I've given you young kings in a while. But remember this. The leaving lights on thing, that is unfortunately something you're better off getting over now. Like, get over it before you marry. Because leaving lights on when they leave a room, that's part of what you sign up for. When you get down on a knee, ring in hand, you may as well be asking, will you marry me? And also, will you make the electric bill go up a little bit every month for as long as we shall live? You better learn to laugh about it, because I'm pretty sure all women and girls do it. I remember my high school girlfriends leaving lights on all the time. And for you ladies listening, if you think it's a money thing, know that I once heard Joel Osteen complaining about his wife leaving lights on. It's just wasteful, and we have a problem with that. But there's probably an unconscious reason for it, since women tend to score so much higher on threat detection and neuroticism. You know, leaving a light on might give them some reduction in anxiety that we're not aware of. Maybe they're not even aware of why they do it. But that could be the reason. Also, they have so many browser tabs open, so many more than we do. And some of them, as you know, will never be closed. That's why they throw flags after the fact. You've seen the football meme with the female referee who throws a flag from week two when it's in the playoffs. So if it bothers you that much, get some sensors or some motion detector lights. That'll be a good investment for you. But don't yell at your wife for leaving lights on. That's ridiculous. Over the last 30 years, the purchasing power of the U.S. consumer dollar has been cut in half thanks to inflation. Over that same time span, the S&P 500 has gained 828%, or 7.7% per year, and that is after adjusting for inflation, which is why you need to be investing for the long run. It's hard to talk about markets without talking about, I mean, I love to look at charts, like, of what the S&P has done versus how much you can purchase. You know, the fact that milk was a quarter when our parents were kids, but if you had invested, how you'd been able to keep up and afford everything just fine. So don't put your money under the mattress. As I talked about last week, it's the earnings of big tech that's pushing markets to all-time highs right now. So we are in an historic rally, and the 17% gain in the S&P 500 over the last 2 months, that is the 20th biggest two-month gain the S&P 500 has had since 1950. You want to know what usually happens next? In the past, following big short-term rallies like we're experiencing now, there have been above-average forward returns, plus 27% average over the subsequent year versus plus 11% in other lesser periods. How about that? Speaking of big tech, the S&P 500's tech sector, its relative strength versus the broad market, is at its highest level in history. It is above the peak of March of 2000. Also, the semiconductor ETF, ticker symbol SOXX, SOX, is up 163% over the past year. Micron makes up about 10% of that fund, followed by, in terms of biggest stocks in the fund, or I should say make up the biggest percentage of the fund behind Micron. In order are AMD, Broadcom, Nvidia, and Intel. That rounds out its top five holdings. Consumer sentiment, which I talked about a few weeks ago. Remember the University of Michigan study I cited saying that consumer sentiment has never been as low as it is now, or at least since they started tracking it in 1952. But consumers are still spending. So retail sales grew 5.2% over the past year and 1.4% after factoring in the fact that we have higher prices. So that's kind of hard to reconcile, huh? Where the usually consumer sentiment and the stock market work in tandem. They both tend to go up in tandem, but not right now. So the rich are getting richer, and most people are not feeling good about spending money. Bolello says what could derail our consumer-driven economy is when inflation outpaces wages, which it has. On a monthly, year-over-year basis, it's done that. Inflation has outpaced wages for the first time since April 2023. One last thing before I was going to finish. I want to finish with a kid say the darndest things, but kind of related. I took my little girl to the pool at the gym last weekend, and when I would take her just a few years ago, she would have her arms wrapped around my neck and wouldn't let go. So she wouldn't go underwater. In fact, she wouldn't even put her face in the water. Nothing. And we had her in swim lessons around that time. She must have been two, maybe three. And so it didn't go well. She would cry and she didn't even want to go, much less get in the pool. And now she's a little older. She's in swim lessons again. And this time she was saying, "Daddy, watch," and jumping in from the side and just acting a fish. So I shared with you last week that we'll be spending the summer in South America. And the building we're staying in, for the first month at least, has a pool and a steam room. Where yet? I'll be using that a lot. But my thought was how much better her experience will be this summer, how much more memorable it can be now that she's put in the work to learn how to swim. And I share that because on a meta level, well, I share it because I can relate, and I hope we all can, in that, well, like for me, in our choice of destination this summer, it reminds me of that, there was a quote I read on the wall in a hotel in Vietnam. It said, the more that you read, the more things you will know. The more that you learn, the more places you'll go. And it had me thinking about how the more you learn about the world, how it broadens your horizons, and you go to one place, and a lot of times that leads you to another place, or learning basic Spanish. Like, I'll tell my single buddies how much learning Spanish can expand your life and increase your options, especially if you like Latinas. So all that is to say, you use your mind as a tool to enhance your experience, and you get to live a bigger life that way. So you learn, you put in the work, and then you get to have more fun. That's kind of how I see it. So kids say the darndest things. I was sitting on the couch. This is one night last week, and my five-year-old comes up to me and says, are you asking AI a question? And I said, yes. I'm like, why? Do you need something? And she says, well, can I ask AI a question? And I said, sure. What do you want to ask? And she put her finger to her lip, and she thought about it for a second. And while she was thinking, I thought, this is the first question she'll ask AI in her life. I wonder how many times she'll do this over the course of her life. Is this one in a million or one in 700 million? Who knows? But I was anxious to see what her question was going to be, because I figured I was going to make note of it and get to tell her about it when she's older. And I was also thinking, usually she asks me questions nonstop. So is she going to ask a question of AI that she could have just asked me? And so all this just takes a second or two. And her first question to AI was, ask, what makes cats and dogs say meow and rough? And I loved it because it led us down a rabbit hole of learning, which was great. She learned how dogs evolve from wolves. So she learned the word evolve, and then she learned the word domesticate. And I didn't know. Did you know this? Did you know why dogs go rough and cats go meow? I'll tell you the part I didn't know, that dogs bark or rough for a lot of reasons. We knew that. But cats meowing, that's only they only do that to communicate with humans, not cat to cat. Amongst themselves, they communicate differently. They use purrs and growls and stuff. So it was news to me. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Share it with a friend if you like it. And I always welcome your feedback. If I can do anything for you, let me know. And my next podcast episode will likely be from Colombia. So take care, friends, and God bless. Bye-bye.